Chapter 5. Chile's victory was total. In exchange for Lima and a bit of its pride, Peru ceded to the victor all of its nitrate-rich desert, including the Tarapacá, as spoils of war. This meant that after 1881, Chile had sole control over the world's only significant deposits of the world's most valuable natural resource. It would be as if today a single nation controlled all the oil wells in the world. Chile was about to become rich. Europe and the United States were by now dependent on nitrates to grow their food and arm their military. By 1900, the United States was using almost half its rapidly increasing tonnage of Chilean nitrates to make high explosives, giving it the power to push through railroad lines, deepen rivers, dig mines and tunnels, level roads, carve Mount Rushmore, and blast through the Panama Canal. It was made possible by Chilean nitrates, tons upon tons of them, the shipments from the Atacama increasing year by year. The more demand grew, the more the Chileans produced. Explosives were especially important in the United States, busily securing its manifest destiny, but just as important, and more important to most European importers, was the use of Chilean nitrate to grow crops. The world population rose rapidly between 1880 and 1900. As workers flocked to fast-growing cities, fewer farmers had to feed more and more factory workers. Diets were changing, too. In the most industrialized nations, shifting away from vegetable and grain sustenance towards richer, more highly processed foods, more meats, sugars, and oils. All of this added up to a dramatically increasing need for higher agricultural yields, which again were made possible by enriching the soil with Chilean nitrates. By 1900, Chile was producing two-thirds of all the fertilizer used on Earth. Among the world's biggest buyers were Great Britain and Germany, two nations where land was limited, but military aspirations were not. Britain, at least, had a world-spanning empire to help grow its food, a commonwealth that stretched from the grain fields of Australia and Canada to the true saltpeter deposits in India. Germany, on the other hand, was formed too late, created in its modern form in the 1870s, to get in on the age of colonial expansion. Without many colonies, Germany had to grow most of its own food on its own generally poor soil. As a result, it became by far the biggest user of Chilean nitrate by the turn of the century, importing more than 350,000 tons a year in 1900 and more than 900,000 tons in 1912, twice the amount imported into the United States and three times that shipped to France. Nitrates were Germany's lifeblood, and their distance from Germany, halfway around the world, became a matter of strategic importance. German entrepreneurs created fleets of majestic windjammers for the nitrate trade, the biggest sailing ships ever built, with clouds of sail that drove them so fast that they were preferred even in the age of steam. The master builder of nitrate windjammers was a Leys company in Hamburg, whose flying P-line ruled the trade for decades. Leys hired the world's best captains and crews, maintained meticulous discipline, developed good relations with port officials, and made the best possible deals with companies who ran the lighters, smaller boats that carried sacks of nitrate out to the massive clippers. It took most ships about 3 months to sail from Iquique to Europe. A Leys clipper once did it in 65 days. Many nitrate ships spent 2 or 3 months in port in Chile. Leys ships were in and out in less than 2 weeks. They turned nitrate shipping into a science. Chile kept up with the rising demand by building more and better refineries in the desert. In the 20 years after Chile's victory in the War of the Pacific, the number of mills more than doubled. The number of workers tripled. Technologies improved, shipments mushroomed, and profits skyrocketed. Soon nitrates were bringing in more than half of Chile's total income. Nitrates would remain the single most important factor in the national economy until the 1930s. Chile did not waste its income as Peru had wasted its guano riches, but invested instead in telephone and electrical systems, transportation networks, and schools, a bigger government, a more professional army, and of course, a top-of-the-line new ironclad for the Chilean Navy. Nitrates paid Chile's entry fee into the modern world. For two decades, from the end of the Nitrate War until the night Crookes gave his speech, no one spoke of a shortage of nitrates. Better refineries kept wringing more out of the diggings. The desert kept producing, and shipments increased year by year. The world demand for nitrates kept rising. Money kept flowing. People acted as if it would never end. John Thomas North, aged 29, debarked in Iquique in 1871. He was one of thousands of British citizens who came to seek their fortune in South America during the nitrate era. He had some training as a mechanic and a keen eye for business, and he started his new life in South America by getting into a surefire business, the shipping of water to Iquique from springs further north. He familiarized himself with the nitrate trade as well, watching as desert properties were bought and sold, and speculating a bit himself if he saw an attractive deal. Then came the war and the Chileans. The takeover of Iquique and the Tarapacá threw all previous ownership, all the deals that Peru had made, into question. In the confusion and uncertainty, many owners were willing to sell cheap. North began buying. He worked closely with the new Chilean inspector of nitrate mills, another British-born emigre, and was soon making serious money buying nitrate properties at distressed sale prices and turning them around, sometimes in the same day, for two or three or four times as much. He advertised his success in London, where he used his growing personal fortune and portfolio of nitrate holdings to float loans to start companies like the Liverpool Nitrate Company Limited, which gathered British investors for more purchases. In the mid-1880s, nitrate speculation went wild in England, thanks in great part to North's enthusiasm. During his increasingly opulent visits home, he described to the rich of his nation the enormous profits to be made by anyone smart enough to buy and sell chunks of the desert and shares in refineries that made nitrate. It was an absolutely necessary commodity. Fortunes were there in Chile for the taking. Enormous investments were made in North's company. North built some refineries himself and then sold stock in them. His investors began making 10, 15, 20% dividends in a single year. The company promoter has only to whisper the magic word nitrates, and the market rises at him, marveled London's Financial News. Speculators started calling Chilean nitrate white gold. The man who had gotten off the boat in Iquique in 1871 was by 1882 Colonel North, England's leading nitrate speculator and one of the richest men. His interest grew to include railroads and more mills. It looked for a while as if he were going to buy up the entire nitrate region. When in Chile, he toured his holdings in a palatial private railroad car. When in England, he lived in an enormous mansion he built outside London. He was introduced to the Prince of Wales. His star reached its zenith in January 1889 when North and his wife hosted a fancy dress ball for 800 at the Hotel Metropole in Whitehall Palace. Present were Sir Randolph Churchill, Baron Alfred de Rothschild, 13 peers, 15 knights, and the Sheriff of London. North dressed as Henry VIII, his wife as the Duchess de Maine. Then the bubble burst. Rampant nitrate speculation, led by North, pushed share prices well beyond the value of the land and mills. To keep returning high profits, the refineries overproduced, flooded the market with nitrates, and held down prices. By the end of the 1890s, shares in nitrate companies were being sold for a quarter the price they had commanded a year or two earlier. One day, North's broker entered the London Exchange to find men piling copies of his latest company's prospectus on the floor and setting them on fire. North kept telling nervous investors that nitrate sales naturally fluctuated, that the core value of his enterprise was buttressed by the value of his railroads alone, and that the long-term future was bright. But even North could not single-handedly keep the nitrate market afloat. As precipitously as they had gone up, the value of nitrate investments went down. North, his fortune depleted but not gone, retreated into private life. Through it all, Chile maintained its profitable and well-ordered business in nitrates. Producers knew what was expected, paid their fees and taxes, and reaped their profits. A reasonable portion of what came in went to Chilean treasury and was used for the betterment of the nation. The industry retained enough to keep its investors happy and to pay for continuing technological advances for the refineries, which were by 1900 many times more efficient than they had been a few decades earlier. Able to profitably work nitrate fields that earlier producers would have scorned. Chile, like Peru, depended on foreign capital and foreign enterprise, mostly European, to power those improvements. Unlike Peru, however, it kept its own people employed in the industry and offered a stable atmosphere for development. A number of companies were Chilean-owned, but by no means the majority. Nitrate ports like Iquique became surprisingly international. There were English mill owners. By 1890, British companies owned 70% of the nitrate mills in Chile. German engineers, Chilean businessmen, government officials and laborers, Spanish, Italian, Bohemian, and French shippers, shop owners, nitrate brokers, and hoteliers, Indians, a few remaining Peruvians, and a community of former Chinese coolies. Iquique, an isolated, waterless fishing village a few decades earlier, was now incongruously cosmopolitan with a grand central square, elegant hotels, and a new opera house. It was a place where bon vivants could entertain themselves at a German tavern or a British club, eat at a Chinese restaurant, attend an opera given by a visiting French troupe, and top it off at an Italian cafe. There were cricket matches and soccer games, shooting parties, elegant balls, and evenings at the theater. That was life along the coast. In the desert, in the nitrate factory belt, life was far different. The growing number of mills drew thousands of poor laborers, many of them former farm workers from southern Chile, lured north by the promise of easy money. In a typical nitrate mill, an entire family would live in a 12-by-12-foot room in a complex of long, low, barracks-like buildings near the works. The men worked 6 days a week in the blazing sun, blasting holes in the desert, digging and hauling caliche, operating crushers, tending boilers, stoking fires, scraping vats, sacking nitrates, and hoisting 300-pound bags onto railroad cars. For this, they received their 3 pesos a day, but not in the form of money. Most nitrate companies paid their workers in fichas, a kind of company scrip redeemable at only company stores. It was as if each nitrate company minted its own money. The ficha system ensured a steady supply of customers for stores that often charge high prices, but its most important effect was to keep a company's workers in place. Trained laborers were valuable. Jobs in the desert were plentiful. If workers could not spend their wages anywhere else, it was unlikely they would move anywhere else. To the workers, the ficha system was a cage, a chain, and a collar. Not only were they charged high prices for every bite of food and drink of liquor, not only were their wages useless in any other town, but the fichas also made saving money useless. Saved fichas could not be spent anywhere else. In many ways, getting paid in fichas was like not getting paid at all. So the workers complained to each other, drank together at the company pulperias, and slowly developed a sense of shared outrage, a sense of being used, and a sense of unity. The men began to listen to Chilean labor activists who talked about communism and anarchism and workers' rights. The women cooked, tended children, shared chores, shopped together at the company market, and stared out at the silent, endless desert. Then they, too, began to talk. Their unhappiness was leavened with feelings of pride. The calicheros and saliteros of the desert, the nitrate workers, saw themselves as unique, strong, among the hardest-working people on earth, and important to their nation. Chile's great poet, Pablo Neruda, spent time in the nitrate fields and ports and understood the breed. He wrote of port workers shoveling salitre into the holds of ships as heroes of a sunrise, creatures of the desert with bodies covered in sweat, chests penetrated by acids, their hearts swollen like crushed eagles until the man drops. The mill workers began organizing, some forming radical theater groups that traveled the desert singing songs and satirizing mill life, others setting up mancomunales, mutual aid associations, early steps towards forming more powerful labor groups. It was the beginning of a long tradition of left-wing political action in Chile. The workers came singing down the long road out of the desert of the Tarapacá and into Iquique in the summer of 1907. There was a mass of them, more than anyone had ever seen in one place before, agitating for an end to the fichas, for better wages, for better lives. The worried townsmen allowed the first workers to camp in the yard of the Santa Maria school, but they kept coming over the next several days, thousands upon thousands pouring out of the desert. Labor demonstrations had started in earnest in the nitrate fields around 1903, tied to the growth of anarcho-syndicalist resistance societies across all Chile for all sorts of laborers. Small strikes were used in the beginning, perhaps a day-long work stoppage at a mill where the men and their families would gather to hear speeches in the plaza. Almost always the mill owners would refuse to bargain, and the government would step in and get the laborers back to work. The 1907 march started the same way, with workers at a nitrate mill near Iquique laying down their tools. This time, instead of staying at the mill, they decided to take their protest into town. At first, it was peaceful. The people in Iquique were interested in the speeches in the schoolyard. A local girl caught the moment in a letter to her grandmother. There were many men, women, and children, grandmothers and grandfathers. They also had their dogs that ran in between their legs as if knowing that they participated in an important event. The women came with baskets, pans, and spoons, the babies against their breasts, and the men with their younger children on their shoulders. It was very hot those days. The camanchaca, the fog, did not bring its usual relief. The heat hovered over the city like a heavy mantle. The days passed, and in spite of the quantity of people, there was an air of hope. According to Juan, the people from the Pampa said they would wait until their petitions were accepted. They wanted to change many things. Grandma, such as, for example, eliminate the fiches and have schools in the afternoon and better medical attention. It is still difficult to know exactly what happened next, because eyewitness accounts differed dramatically. It is known that around 1900, the total population of Iquique was about 16,000. After a few days, the number of protesters around the Santa Maria schoolyard grew to be somewhere between 6,000 and 20,000 workers and family members, depending on whether you use the figures given by newspapermen, government officials, or labor activists. It appears they were entirely peaceful. A strike committee was set up, and people spent their time talking, educating one another, and planning next steps. There was something of a holiday atmosphere. Instead of back-breaking labor, the strikers got to rest, eat, and listen. The strikers were impressed by the power of their own numbers. For a few days, there was a sense that the sheer presence of so many workers, plus a firm refusal to leave Iquique until they were heard, would result finally in an end to the fiches, or better wages, or some kind of movement by the owners. Iquique town officials notified the government in Santiago, requested help to maintain order, and tried to mediate agreements between the management and the workers. But talks fell through after the mill owners flatly refused all demands. Chile's president tried to step in, offering to pay half the raise demanded by the workers if the owners contributed the other half. But that, too, was rejected. Now the townspeople began to worry. How were the workers to be fed? They were drinking all the town's water. There were no big problems yet, but if any were to arise, Iquique's few police would be overwhelmed. The holiday mood began to evaporate. Two Chilean ships arrived carrying a military force under the command of a tough-minded general, Roberto Silva Renard. The Chilean government was alarmed about the size of the desert protest, the refusal of the workers to return to their mills, and especially about the example this provocation would set for workers in the rest of the country. They did not want the Iquique gathering to spark a nationwide workers' revolution. General Silva was ordered to end the strike. Silva had machine guns from the ships set up at the schoolyard. Soldiers surrounded the workers. Martial law was declared. On the afternoon of December 21, 1907, the longest day of the year in Iquique, Silva gave the strikers a deadline to disperse. Instead of leaving, the strike committee called a meeting on a school balcony under the flag of Chile. The workers in the schoolyard stayed with them. The general's deadline passed. Then shortly afterward, the soldiers surrounding the schoolyard were ordered to ready their arms. Some of the soldiers, especially some who had grown up in Iquique, refused to raise their guns. Silva turned to men from the ships, men who came from other parts of Chile. The sailors manning the machine guns. They were ordered to fire. The strike leaders under the flag were shot first. As though struck by lightning, they fell, wrote a witness. The crowd panicked. It was reported that some of the strikers had weapons and might have tried to use them. The machine gunners strafed the schoolyard, firing for what seemed like a few minutes. No one was quite sure. There were cries and screams. There were many women and children. The crowd broke and ran. The schoolyard emptied. Only bodies were left behind. Iquique officials claim that 126 strikers died. The British minister in Santiago estimated somewhere around 500. Historians now believe that somewhere between 1,000 and 3,000 workers, spouses, and children were killed. There were no reports of any military casualties. The surviving workers streamed back up the hills and across the desert to their mills. It was the deadliest incident in the world labor history. The Iquique Massacre, as it became known, broke the back of organized labor in the nitrate fields. Eventually, the owners finally abandoned the ficha system, but at their own speed in their own time. The Chilean military changed its rules so that soldiers would no longer be given active duty in their hometowns. Years later, General Silva, the man who gave the order to fire, was assassinated by a relative of one of the Iquique dead. The workers did not know it. The owners did not know it. The government leaders did not know it. But the heyday of Chilean nitrates was nearing its end. In 1907, the year of the Iquique Massacre, 200 mills were operating in the desert. By 1940, only a handful was still putting out nitrate. The rest were already ghost towns scattered across the desert. Today, Iquique, much of it looking as if it had been frozen in time in 1907, is working to reinvent itself as a resort town. The calicheros, the salitreros, and the mill owners are gone, but not because the Chileans stripped the Atacama of nitrate as the Peruvians stripped the guano. There is still plenty of nitrate in Chile. What ended Chile's nitrate age was not shortage, but plenty. Just as the workers were marching into Iquique, half a world away, a German chemist was channeling his anger into perfecting a machine that would within 30 years bring down the entire Chilean industry. The man was Fritz Haber. The machine he was working on, it was said, could turn air into bread.